from the latest on Caribbean cruises to kosher safaris, pilgrimages to Jewish Eastern Europe, and award-winning wines and international cuisine in sun-drenched Tel Aviv. Sit back and enjoy the trip with the travel edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast.
And a very sunny good morning.
It's another hot one.
Yes. I feel like we're stood in a Roman amphitheatre / Colosseum. Where are we?
You want me to say the name of the place, don't you?
Just for comedy value.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kashmiria's.
I think you should pass the microphone.
Already at this stage.
Guide Bertha,
okay.
So we can...
Where on earth are we? Introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the place we are.
Hello, everybody. My name is Beata Kędzierska, and we are in Kazimierz Dolny in Poland.
That's what it should sound like.
I'm going to be your tour guide today, but usually I'm a tour guide in Nalęczów, where our tour is vintage cars.
Ooh.
With hats on our head, and we're trying to put you back in the 19th century.
Bertha is stood here with a beautiful wide-brimmed hat covered with flowers.
And we should also say good morning to our other guide, Ella. Thank you very much indeed.
Hello, I am Ella. I am a guide also in Kazimierz, and I am owner of trademark Night Sightseeing of Kazimierz.
That sounds really nice as well. Unfortunately, we're not here at night. We're only here in the daytime. But it's certainly worth noting for people who come here at night. So, where are we now?
We are in the castle, in Kazimierz Dolny. The castle was built in the 14th century, thanks to King Kazimierz the Greatest. He was the most famous king because he built over 40 castles in whole Poland. When he built castles, he enclosed them with walls. Before him, everything what was building was made from wood, and after him is made from stones.
We've just gone up some stairs to one of the ramparts of the castle. This part looks newly rebuilt with wooden decking. It gives us a view of the Vistula River, the river that runs pretty much all the way through Poland, and is a spectacular view. We can see all the rooftops of the houses in the town, wooden rooftops, red brick rooftops, and then behind it just fields and trees. So I hear there's a story about King Kazimierz and a particular love that he had.
Yes, he had beloved named Estera, and she was really young, and she was Jewish. She was young. He was over 50 years, but you know, love is love. And from this castle in Kazimierz, he built another one for her. And at night, he slept through the dungeons to see her beloved Estera. Her mother wasn't so happy with it. She went to the king and she asked him, okay, what is with my daughter? He said, oh, okay, it's really lovely, lovely. Okay, but my daughter isn't that old as you are. So, mother of Estera came to her and she's asking her how is with the king. And Estera says, brilliant, this is really lovely, you know, king. And we are so happy together. And mother asks, okay, but how is in the sleeping room? And Estera went red and she says, really, really lovely, just fantastic. First night was 3 times. The second night was 5. And the third was 7. And the mother went to the king and she says, this is not right. What are you doing with my daughter? She's so young. And he says, mother, your daughter is really beautiful. But she has no experience in this way. And in counting also. Because she doesn't count the whole act, only the way and back. We are on the Market Square, the center and the heart of the city. Lots of tenders, lots of villas here. It's not all of them original. The most important are those two in front of us, two brothers, Przybyłowie, Mikołaj and Christopher. Now we are on a different square, Market Square, the smaller one. it was a Jewish center. They lived here in a wooden houses, small wooden houses, and here was a lot of them. They were even more than 17% of people from Kazimierz. And in front of us we have synagogue, we have butchers.
The synagogue survived the war?
No, unfortunately everything was destroyed during the Second World War. And what we can see now, it was rebuilt.
We've now come inside the rebuilt synagogue. This is a place that was built by the town itself after the Second World War. As various parts of the town were reconstructed, there is a former butcher's shop that has been built outside out of wood, a long, low building. And here we're inside a stone synagogue with a wooden internal roof, which is domed with various wooden panels reaching up to the center. Inside, there are no signs of a bima, of an ark for the Torah, but around are lots and lots of photographs. And now we're going to hear from Berta what we're looking at.
Now we are looking at city before the Second World War and after it. We can see how Jewish lived here in a small wooden houses. And also we can see how damaged the city was after the Second World War.
What we're looking at is an image of a lot of horses, yes, and carts. All of the women appear to be wearing traditional clothing. These are going to be Catholic women who have their heads covered in a white shawl. What we're looking at now is what I think you would say is a fairly typical photograph that we would see of Meir Sha'arim in Jerusalem today. People are in exactly the same type of clothing. But behind, to the left, we also see people who were Poles, who were just walking around in traditional, in Polish clothing of the pre-war period. And the two are conducting their lives at the same time, side by side, in this town.
Across from the synagogue, you can come into the Museum of the Goldsmiths, which has a interesting collection split into three parts: the religious artifacts, jewellery, and the type of items you'd find on the dining table. And within the religious artifacts, there is an interesting exhibition of Judaica as well. A 2 to 3 minute drive from the city, and here behind us is a wall that seems to be made from Jewish gravestones, and a sign over there saying the Jewish cemetery. What's the story behind this wall and the cemetery here?
The Jewish cemetery first came up in 18th century. This matzevas during the Second World War were destroyed and they were put down to the road. After the Second World, they were brought back again here in this wall.
So these stones would have formed part of the roads and have been recreated into this wall. In the cemetery here by a tree is a very small plaque that says, "Remember, we are four generations of sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters of our families that were all murdered here by the Nazis in 1942. We were here, witnessed, and will remember it all." This is the execution spot within the cemetery that the Nazis used in Kazimierz.
And we've suddenly gone into what is a very unusual cemetery for those of us who are used to cemeteries in America, in the UK, and in Israel, in that we are in a wood. The burial plots are all under trees that are fully grown, that clearly were here at the time that people were being buried. These have not been planted subsequently. And it gives a very unusual, very peaceful, and also, as Ella said, a darker feel to this cemetery. As with everywhere else we have been on this trip, our time in Kazimierz Dolny has been very short. It's been very informative, very educational, also very emotional and moving. And on top of all of that, the wonderful, wonderful scenery. If anybody comes here to see the vistas from the castle, of the Vistula, of the old town itself, I want to thank both of you so much for having brought us here. To Ella and to Berta, thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
You are welcome.
Much of Poland is rural. A lot of it is very flat when you get away from the Carpathians. Here and there, dotted around the country, are magnificent palaces. We've come to one now, and we are in the company of Magdalena Pilaszk or Pilask?
Pilska. Pilsak. I have a problem with pronunciation of my own name. Yes, Magda. It will be much easier.
So. Tell us a little bit about the place where you work.
When we are talking about the Polish residences, we have only a few places like this one on whole map with still original interiors. So Kozłówka survived Second World War almost without damages. So that's why it's a special place. This was a typical Baroque, late Baroque style residence, but interiors were changed completely at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. So when we were go inside, you can see collection of 480 canvas. Most of them were made special for Konstanty Zamoyski, but they were made as a replicas, as a copies, because originals were in famous galleries, and Konstanty wanted to create his own small Versailles. So that's why we have many influences from French art.
Before we go inside, before we wander around, a few words about Zamoyski, the family, the person.
Zamoyski family from the 16th century, it was one of the most important, prominent Polish families, because we can say they were second after king. It was time of magnates, so they were having enormous properties, sometimes much bigger than the properties of Polish kings. And they were able to decide who will be on Polish throne, because there was a time of free elections. So that's why it was very important to create proper relations to the magnates like Zamoyski. In the 16th century, Jan Zamoyski, creator of Zamość, the most impressive place connected with this family, he was a candidate for a Polish throne, but he didn't want to be Polish king because he was almost he was king without the crown.
David and I have just spent 30-40 minutes on a beautiful tour of the house here, and Magda has shown around what one could describe as the Polish equivalent of Downton Abbey. That you walk around, there's a hunting room, a billiard room, a library, the kitchen with hundreds and hundreds of glasses and plates with the family insignia on, bedrooms, and hundreds of pieces of art of the Zamoyski family. It is a truly, truly remarkable building with a remarkable history, particularly seeing pictures of the modern Zamoyski family who now live in Canada, juxtaposed against the old Zamoyski family, some photos taken in the same places. Magda, thank you for bringing us here.
For me, it was also an enormous pleasure. So we are waiting for the visitors. So every time when you will be near Kozłówka, you have to be here.
We've finally made it to Lublin. We've only seen a very small corner of the city, but it looks magnificent. But the first place we've been brought to is the castle area, and within it, the castle chapel. We have the most wonderful, knowledgeable guide. Tell us who you are and where we're standing now.
My name is Anna Czajczyk. I work at Educational Department of the National Museum in Lublin, and I'm pleased to present you absolutely the most important and valuable monument of our city, the Holy Trinity Castle Chapel. It's the castle chapel dedicated to the Holy Trinity from the European Cultural Heritage List, from the list the monuments of Polish history, one of seven new wonders of Poland, well-kept monument 2017, awarded many times for restoration works carried out here.
We are surrounded by biblical story after story from both Old and New Testaments. They've been restored, but most of them look as though they were only finished yesterday. But in fact, they date back 600 years?
Yes, these frescoes were made in the beginning of the 15th century. They were completed on St. Lawrence's Day, on the 10th of August, 1418. And we have a fragment of the dedicatory inscription made in Cyrillic. We know the name of a head artist, Andrew, and the date of the completion. But thanks to conservators, we know three names today: Andrew, Cyril, and Yushko, probably Ruthenian artist invited here by Władysław Jagiełło, who was a founder of these frescoes.
This chapel is no longer in use, other than two times a year, once for the Festival of the Trinity, and the other, a sad story about the adjoining prison.
Yes, this chapel was for many centuries the castle chapel, visited by all Polish rulers, Polish gentry, nobility, sometimes by townspeople, but it was a prison chapel too. But from the middle of the 20th century, it's a museum chapel visited by tourists.
And unfortunately, some of those prisoners, 300 of those prisoners, were killed.
Of course, the castle hill is a place of martyrdom. Many thousands of people from the Second World War, for the time of communism. So this chapel was always the prison chapel too.
We stood in the gallery. We have done a whistle-stop tour of all of the exhibitions in what was the old prison. You can smell the new wood and everything in here. It's an amazing couple of floors of wonderful exhibitions. We finally stopped running after you and trying to find out what there is in this museum, but there is so much at this one particular painting. What is this painting and what does it depict?
We can see the reception of Jews to Poland, a painting by Jan Matejko, made in 1889 as a commission of Arnold Rapaport, a Jewish politician, a Jewish lawyer, who ordered this painting, and Matejko only this small oil sketch from 1 from 12 painted in this large form. It presents the admission of Jewish community in Poland by the Polish Duke Władysław Herman, his two sons Bolesław Krzywousty, Catholic Bishop Marcin, and Voivod Sieciech. To the left, we can see the Jewish community with Rabbi Benjamin from Tudela.
I've climbed the 100 or so stairs of the tower of the castle, overlooking the prison and with a view all the way around Lublin. I can see the seven hills of Lublin, although when we recounted them, there were about 5.5. The old city in front of me. We're going to have one last word with Anina before we wave goodbye.
We are at the top of the tower, the only monument in the Romanesque style, and we can six or seven hills where Lublin was born. The Czwartek, the Thursday Hill, the Grodzisko or Kirkut Hill, Białkowska Góra Hill, the Castle Hill, the Old Town Hill, with the Old Town and all absolutely wonderful monuments, and the last, Żmigród Hill.
Nina, it's been a wonderful tour. I've been out of breath from the start because we've tried to do the whole National Museum of Lublin in under 2 hours. You could spend days here if you really wanted. We've seen some wonderful pieces. We've had a beautiful tour of the chapel, but unfortunately, it's time to say goodbye to Anina. Anina, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here on a stairwell to the side of our hotel, the Elan Hotel, is a picture of Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, a picture of 30 or 40 students on the stairs. What's very striking about this building compared to a lot of other Jewish institutions in southeast Poland. Is the building is completely intact, certainly from the outside. The lettering is there. It looks like an active yeshiva. But the yeshiva has quite a short active history as a yeshiva, but an amazing story to tell.
My name is Maciej Barachewicz. I'm a guide in Lublin. Try to tell you about history of Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, story of Lublin. So history of Yeshivas Chachmei is very interesting, but unfortunately very short. Yeshiva start at 1930, so 9 years before the Second World War was opened. Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin was opened by one very important person, Meir Shapira, and he think about open big yeshiva in Lublin many years before. In 1924 in Vienna, there was a World Jewish Congress. He started to tell about build a big school in Lublin. Why in Lublin? This a question about history of Lublin, because in Lublin, in long our history, we were connected with a Jewish community. And I think first reason of building school in Lublin was the name of Lublin, because many Jews in the world called Lublin as a Jerusalem of the Polish kingdom, because here was a big Jewish community. It was very important place for Jewish history, for especially for religion Jews. Meir Shapira built yeshiva in 1930. Unfortunately, he died 3 years after, in 1933. But yeshiva was still famous, was still in the top of the world. In the Second World War, when Lublin, when Poland and Lublin was under German occupation, in yeshiva was hospital, and it was the reason why they not destroyed this building, because it was a huge building, it was modern building, and building survived. Unfortunately, all students and teachers, professors were sent to the death camp in Bełżec, most of them. Now in the building we can see the small museum, the synagogue, we can visit, see something, we can learn something about the history of yeshiva. And one part of building of yeshiva, in the part of building of yeshiva, is Hotel Ilan. It's good 4 stars hotel for tourists.
Hotel Ilan, Ilan is a Hebrew word for a tree. There's a restaurant in here called the Olive Tree. Who owns the hotel, and why was a hotel built within this building? What was the logic behind it?
After the Second World War, this building belongs to the medical school. About 12 years ago, this building back to Warsaw Jewish community, and they decide to open hotel, restaurant. Also, here is possible to order kosher food in this restaurant. It is the only place in Lublin like this with kosher food. And part is a kind of museum, synagogue. I think it is good for tourists, because in the one place they can sleep, they can eat, and they can visit, and they can know the history.
I've just spent about 10 minutes rifling through the Sidurim and the books in the Sifraya, the library of the yeshiva next to the Bet Knesset, and a large proportion of them seem to come from Dublin. David and I have friends in Dublin, so we've been playing Jewish geography to see who we know. We did find a book from one of David's best friends' grandparents in Manchester, but it's a collection of books given by synagogues and organizations from around the world, but a lot from Ireland and England. On the opposite wall is a picture of the founder of the yeshiva, sat studying with the original collection of books, But alas, they're no longer here.
Yes, Meir Shapira was the very religious man, and he was the founder of Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi means the religion Jews read every day one page of Talmud. It is a 7 years cycle.
אז כתוב גם גנב וגם גזלן וגם תשלומי כפל וגם תשלומי ארבעה וחמישה. אז כפל וארבעה וחמישה הוא לא מונה כי מקנס הוא לא קבע.
It's kind of surreal where we are now. I don't know if you can hear in the background the music, but it's very Israeli music. We've also had lots and lots of Yiddish music over the last hour or so. Mark, what was the name of the beer? Not the one that you're on now, the one before that. What was it called?
So I've just had a lovely bottle of malt beer, alcoholic malt beer, called Kosher Macha.
So it's called Kosher Macha, but it's not actually kosher.
I don't believe so, but I don't think it contained anything that wasn't kosher.
No. So we're sitting in a restaurant in the old town in Lublin. The waiting staff, I guess, are dressed to a large extent the way you would imagine Jewish women may have dressed way back when. The
head coverings.
The walls are filled with Yiddishisms. There are photos of rabbis.
Hasidic music in the background.
We're in a restaurant which is not kosher, but feels very, very Jewish. The menu, chopped liver.
Hummus.
Hummus is the exception.
Herring.
Pierogi.
Latkes during the winter.
All of the traditional Ashkenazi food, none of it kosher. And our tour guide, Marcin, was explaining to us that the family who run this restaurant do have some Jewish roots, but basically it's a non-Jewish family, but just believe that that it's important to keep these things alive. And now what we're going to do is take a little evening stroll around the old town. We're in the old town at the moment of Lublin, and see how it's been reconstructed post-war and looks as stunning as any other old town in Eastern Europe. So let's put on our shoes again and take to the path.
Let's walk off the herring and latkes.
Absolutely.
Slowly walking off our beer, our Kosher Macha beer, we've had a walk from the old town through a lovely pedestrianised street and through a square with fountains. And we've come to a camera. Well, it looks like a camera or a video screen in a circle. What is this?
This is eye which looks to the Vilnius. Why Vilnius? Because we are in the Lithuanian square. It is central square in Lublin. And Lithuanian square is related with history of Lublin Union. Lublin Union was a pact between Poland and Lithuania, signed in 1569. And it is kind of our strong relations with Poland and Lithuania.
I can't tell whether it's raining or it's just a bad camera, but there's no one in Vilnius. They've all gone home.
Yes, it looks like raining. I'm not sure it is it is raining or looks like.
But we've seen people just coming up to this camera in Vilnius, waving at people in Lublin. It's a really nice idea.
Lubelski Region Fact File. Warsaw Chopin Airport is in the neighbouring region and is the gateway for international flights into Poland, including direct flights from Tel Aviv. The main airport in the Lubelski region is Lublin Airport. It's used by budget airlines for flights from the UK, Ireland, Netherlands and Turkey. The airport is also served by LOT from Warsaw. Getting from Warsaw Chopin Airport to Lublin takes about 2 hours. From Lublin Airport to the city centre, it's around 15 minutes by car or bus. There are shuttle buses on the route from Lublin Airport to the downtown, as well as taxis available at the entrance to the terminal. You can also use Bolt. Lublin has public transport, buses and taxis, as well as taxi apps. For interregional travel, you can rent a car or buy a ticket for an interregional bus ride. Lublin has global hotel chains including Mercure, Hilton, Ibis, Campanile and Focus. The Hotel Ilan is in the restored Lublin Yeshiva. Those wishing to take a rest from the busy city life can go to picturesque surroundings of Lublin, including Rozdotche, Kazimierz Dolny, Nowichov, Zamoshk, Polesi, and many others. One US dollar will buy you 3.7 Polish zloty. The climate in Poland is temperate. The average temperature in the summer is 19 degrees Celsius or 66 Fahrenheit. However, on some days, temperatures can reach 30 degrees Celsius or 86 Fahrenheit. January and February are the coldest months with temperatures below freezing. The culinary heritage of the Lublin region is related to its border location at the meeting point of the cultures of East and West. The range of regional dishes and flavours is very rich and varied. Jewish style food is available in a number of restaurants in Lublin and beyond.
Another good morning, another day. We are still in the Lublin region. In fact, we are within the municipal area, the boundaries of Lublin, but it's as if we've come into a completely different world this morning.
Another day, another zloty, as they say here. Yes, we're at the Lublin Open Air Village Museum, trying to walk carefully amongst the tree roots in the forest, the birds singing around us. The Lublin Open Air Village Museum brings buildings and village life from the last 300 years into an open air collection of buildings to try and give that feel of village life and Lublin life, I think up until the First World War era and dating back 100, 200 years before that.
Once again, we have a wonderful guide who speaks beautiful English, and we will hear from her in a minute or two.
My name is Bogna, and I'm your guide for this morning. And the village that we are in represents Lublin upland. And all cottages that are situated here were brought from that area. We are in a house from Żabno, which was built in 1895. It was built by two brothers as a wedding gift for their sister.
Most of history talks about men, talks about the men as the fighters. That's the major part of what we learn in history, and we learn about farming and industry and so on. But here in the home, from what you were saying before we started recording, this is very much the place of the woman, and where she came up with all sorts of really interesting inventions, I guess, to deal with everyday life. So if we could start by explaining a little bit about the medicinal side.
Here, practically in every home, the woman was the doctor of the family, and all medicine available here would be herbs, and she was in charge of it. She knew where to pick it, how to dry it. She would make a treatment for her family and also for animals that she kept in farm.
And beyond that, how much was the woman responsible for, say, as we see in the gardens here, there are herbs, and how much would she go beyond the house into the fields, or was a woman predominantly in the home, also as we see here with, for example, a loom for making clothing?
You see, the conditions of living in the village were very hard. So we could say that the whole family was working. The most important person would be the man, but because he would be in charge of the hardest work. In fact, he was the one that they would care most about, because if he was missing, the whole family would not survive. That's how hard the conditions was. A woman was in charge of a lot of work in the house and around the house, like in some houses nowadays, but also children were involved in work. They were starting working at the age of 5 years old. They would be like in charge of small poultry, feeding them and taking them out into the fields. But woman was not only the doctor, but also she would do the laundry. She would make her own bread, working on flax and making clothes. The thing was, they were trying to be as much self-sufficient as they could. Much more self-sufficient as we are now.
We've come to a larger cottage that was bought from a farmstead in Zhukov from a family with three generations that lived here. There's a very interesting shelf in the middle of this cottage. What was stored there?
That was a shelf to put the bread on. It's high up and underneath the ceiling because the bread was kept away from not only from rats and mice, but also from children. It was limited by the mother. She was in charge of making bread and in charge of spreading it between the members of family. Here the bread was put and ready to be served. There was a custom that if somebody would come here as a guest and asked for bread, if bread was at home, he had to be given it.
Mark and I, throughout this trip to Poland, have been wondering what a Jewish home, a shtetl, the village of Jews, would have looked like. And now maybe we have the answer.
In our museum, we have a little town section. The assumption is that our little town was inhabited by Jewish people in 50%. But it was very difficult to arrange the exhibition because there was no interviews with children or grandchildren, people that actually lived here. So we are in front of the house from Siedliszcze, which is a copy of original, which before the war was inhabited by Liebhaber family. And the sources for this exhibition was very rare interviews with Catholic neighbors, that people that were living here, very rare photographs. And the great source were the marriage articles, which was set before the young Jewish people got married, because they listed everything that was brought into their common house. And they mentioned big pieces of furniture, but also the little pieces of jewelry or clothes or other small things. So we are looking at the blue interior. Jewish people painted their houses very blue. Easy to recognize as a Jewish interior because you can see the kosher rules set here. The left part of the wall, covered with plaster, is arranged as dishes for meat products. The ones in front are dairy products.
Let me just add a little bit to try to paint a picture. So on the left side, as you said, is the meat area. There are two loaves, two chalot, ready for a Sabbath
yes.
meal. I see a sewing machine, so presumably somebody in the family was making clothes for other people around.
Yes, as well as and for the members
and also
of
for the family.
Family.
We see the steps up, so they had two floors in this particular home.
Yes.
If you imagine steps on a boat, on a ship, they're very, very steep. They're wooden. There's no banister. If you'd had one or two drinks, it would be very difficult to walk up and down these steps. And what you've done, which is beautiful, on each step, there is a pair of shoes. And I'm assuming these shoes date back to the pre-war
period. Yes, they are original.
Everything we're looking at, not just in this Jewish home, but throughout the village, is
down to detail.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about how you, to build these homes or recreate these homes, you were interviewing people.
Yes.
The research must be fascinating.
It is, yes. It was a great work done by the people years back, because some of the people that were interviewed are not here anymore. And there was photographs were very handful because, for example, the bed, the metal one, that appeared on one of the photographs. The arrangements of pots, the cloths that were needlework on the cloths that were exposed on walls. That's all sources on photographs. Here you can see the two-handle mug for ablutions at the right-hand side.
Next to the bed.
Yes.
Because that is when somebody would wake up in the morning, the first thing they do would be to wash their hands before they got
yes,
up.
Yes, but also by the door, because when the man came from the market square, he also did that.
It's amazing. For us as Jews who have our roots in Poland, in Ukraine, in Latvia, to see this, I've seen a few photographs, but I've never seen an actual recreation pretty much in situ, in the region. that does this. So thank you for that.
When I was working, looking after this exhibition at some point, I met many people coming from Israel, coming from various places of world, really, and they were quite moved, and it was also quite an experience for me.
Just one thing I observed on the door here, there's not a model mezuzah?
There is one, but you'd have to close the door in order to see it.
Really, really down to the fine detail. This is fabulous.
I've met people in Lublin fascinated by mezuzahs, and they would search the staircases in Lublin's old town looking for mezuzahs, but they're not there anymore, but only for the mark of it underneath the paint somewhere.
This place is absolutely fascinating, and I want to thank you for your time.
Leave us
with this thought. How much pleasure do you get out of working in somewhere like this?
A lot of pleasure. I often work here with children, and it's surprising that some of them, they really appreciate visiting here. And of course, it's a pleasure to meet the older visitors as well, because they treat it as a travel to their childhood. So that gives a really good satisfaction.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is probably the most difficult part of this trip. David and I spent quite a few frantic hours discussing what we did, how we do this. I'm in the shadow of the Gate Memorial in Majdanek at the Lublin concentration camp on the edge of Lublin. In the distance, I can see the mausoleum. David and I have spent this morning walking round with an excellent guide, understanding what happened on this site.
We don't want to turn this particular podcast into something depressing. After all, you're here to listen to our tales of adventure, our depictions of the places that we are, the great journeys that you can take. But perhaps what is unique about this podcast and about joining a travel show with the Jerusalem Post is that we take a slightly different, a unique approach to travel and tourism. We travel to places that are fun. Only recently we were in Abu Dhabi. We've brought you the sights and sounds of tourism in Canada, of culinary values in America. Soon we'll be taking you to various parts of Africa and Latin America and the Far East. But for the Ashkenazim, and indeed many Jews who lived in the Middle East, for those of us alive in the 21st century, we always remember, we always owe a debt of gratitude to those who came before us, to those who created Jewish institutions, to those who passed on not just religious values, but just passed on our history that has gone on for thousands of years. And today we're just taking a couple of minutes to pause and to remember those who were unable to join us on that journey after 1944 in the case of Lublin and 1945 for much of Europe.
After 5 days, we've hit the final stop of our tour, still in the Lublin region. But we've come to the beautiful city of, my last chance to mispronounce something, Zamość.
It's Zamość.
Oh, that was close, actually.
You were close.
And I'm with a wonderful tour guide, full of enthusiasm, although we'll wear him out over the next hour or so. Daniel, tell us a little bit about yourself and where we stood.
Okay, so my name is Daniel Sobaczyński, and I'm a local tour guide about Zamość and Zamość surroundings. And right now we're standing at the Great Market of Zamość, which is a big market, a big square with the 100 meter site. If we could travel in time and be here about 400 years ago, here there would be nothing. No place, no village, no houses, just the empty field, and the Wabunka River, which is floating nearby. And in the year 1580, the great Polish nobleman John Zamoyski decided to build here a city. First, he decided to build a palace for himself, but because he was rich enough, he built the palace together with the city. He was rich because he was like a right hand of the Polish king, so the second important person in Poland, just after the Polish king. He was hetman and counselor, so it means that he was chief of the Polish army and the chief of the king's office. So rather a big, very important person. John Zamoyski was studying in Italy, so he studied in Italy and he fell in love into the style of the Renaissance Italian cities. When he came to Poland, he had money, so he decided to build an Italian-style city in Poland. So he hired an Italian architect, Bernardo Morando, and told him, build me an Italian-style city in Poland. And that's how Zamość was built.
He's certainly done that. The thing that initially hits you when you're in the square is the color. Every house is a different color.
Yes, every house is a different color, but when you look at them, they're more or less similar. So they had the arcade passage on the first floor. So as you can see, you can go around the market and do your shopping, no matter if it's a heavy rain or heavy snow or heavy sun like today. You can do your shopping, so the trade in the city didn't depend on weather. Also, all the houses are more or less the same, so they are built in the late Renaissance style with the invisible roof, like this. We have the decorative wall on the top and the roof is not, it should be not visible. Zamoyski wanted Zamość to be an ideal city. And the ideal city is an Italian idea of the Renaissance city, which is both comfortable for the people to live inside and also beautiful. And in Zamość, as you can see, we are standing in the center of the market. All the streets are very wide. Because of this, we have the natural air condition in the city, so it was comfortable to be here. The streets cross each other with the right angle, so the plan of the city is very, very simple.
My questions are usually wrong, so feel free to correct me. I've heard the word Armenia mentioned numerous times in connection with this town, and I think maybe this square in particular. What's that about? Because we're in Poland, you've mm-hmm. talked about Italy, so what's Armenia got to do with the story?
We have to say that John Zamoyski had a few ideas for Zamość, and he also wanted Zamość to be a shopping center. So he wanted Zamość to be the trade and economical center of region, so the people would come here and do their shoppings. He also wanted Zamość to be lived only by Catholic people, so there would be no conflicts. But soon after the city had started, he understood that in the situation when only the Catholic people lived in the city, there was no trade. Because the traders and buyers were believed in different religions, so to increase the economical growth of Zamość, John Zamoyski decided to invite other nations here to Zamość. Of course, it was not an open invitation, but he invited only these nations who could have a good influence for the city's economical situation. So that's why he invited rich Armenian traders, rich Jewish traders, and the Greeks that were told to be a very good craftsman that time. So Zamość became, from this only Catholic city, Zamość became a multicultural city.
There have been many synagogues on our journey around Poland. In numerous cases, it's places where they used to be. In some cases, it's where they were restored but remain empty. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this is a synagogue as it always was.
Yes, and it's unique because it's the only synagogue in Poland, the only one that was built by Sephardic Jews. And it's also unique because it still exists in the late Renaissance style. The synagogue had to look like the other buildings in town, so it had to be similar to the other buildings. That's why it was built in the late Renaissance style. It's Sephardic, but also had some Ashkenazi influence, especially the women's section, which was built later. Many of the Polish synagogues, for example, in Krakow, were rebuilt in 18th-19th century. This one looked exactly the same like it looked in the 17th century. So let's go inside.
Why in the middle of Eastern Europe, between Krakow and Lviv, is there a Sephardic community?
Mm-hmm. From a very simple reason. The Sephardic Jews were traders, rich traders selling goods from the Middle East. So they were trading with the Arabic countries and bringing the goods to the Western Europe. And Zamość was on the trade route, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea and from the Black Sea to the Western Europe. And they just settled on the trade route. As you can see, we are inside of the Zamość Synagogue, and it's not very big, it's 10 meters. That was, of course, the main hall for men, which was built first, because the Sephardic Jews, first they built here a wooden synagogue. But because Zamość was supposed to be the powerful fortress, it was forbidden to build the buildings of wood. So in 1610, they started to build this late Renaissance synagogue. First they built the main hall, then they added the women's sections on the two sides of the building. When you look at the walls, you can see that this synagogue is very bright, because most of the Polish synagogues are dark, with dark gray, dark blue, with brown colors. But here we have the Sephardic style, the late Renaissance style. So we don't have paintings on the walls, but we have the stucco works, which are typical for the late Italian Renaissance, with a lot of plants ornamentation, which is typical for Jewish art, but also typical for the Italian Renaissance. We have the shell in every corner of the synagogue, which reminds us the Mediterranean Sea and the art of Italy, the art of Spain.
Was this the only synagogue in town?
At the beginning, yes. Of course, there were a few private prayer houses, but that was the only synagogue in the old town at the beginning. Later in the 19th century, the Jewish community in Zamość divided into two groups. The old town was lived by this rich and well-educated part of the community. The poor ones lived in the suburbs. After the wars of the 17th century, Zamość became a very poor town, because no one was coming to Zamość to do their shoppings, so the Sephardic Jews left the city and moved to the bigger cities. So the synagogue was empty. The city authorities changed their mind and allowed the Ashkenazi Jews to live inside of Zamość, especially that only the rich ones could afford to live in Zamość, because the prices of the houses were expensive, because as the powerful fortress, it was a safe place to live. So this Jewish community here in the old town in Zamość was always a very rich, which means well assimilated and well educated. In the 17th century, the Jewish community founded a yeshiva in Zamość. And in the 18th, 19th century, when the Hasidic movement became very popular in Poland, here in the old town of Zamość, there was no Hasidic people. Zamość became a capital of Haskalah, so the Jewish Enlightenment. So the intellectual movement focused on Jewish art, literature, on science. That was attractive for the Jewish community in Zamość. That's why we had Itzhak Peretz, Ugandan parents, born and live. He was born here in Zamość. He lived here. He started to write here in Zamość.
As we always have to do on this trip, bring us forward to 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Before World War II, 12,000 Jewish people lived in Zamość, which was about 40% of the people living here in Zamość.
And when the war started in September 1939, Zamość was very quick invaded by the German troops. But according to the Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement, which actually started the World War II, Zamość was supposed to be in the Soviet Union. So the Germans left the city and the Red Army came to Zamość. Red Army was here for about 2 weeks because on October 1939 there was a border correction and Zamość get back to the Nazi occupation zone. The ghetto in Zamość became a transit ghetto. So the Germans brought here Jewish people from different cities, from Czechoslovakia, even from Germany. And later they took it from Zamość mostly to the death camp in Bełżec. Smaller groups were taken to the German death camps in Sobibór and Majdanek. The ghetto was closed on November 1942. And the Zamość was announced by the German authorities to be free of Jewish people. From these 12,000 people that live here before the war, about 350 people came back to Zamość. About 50 people survived here in the occupied Poland, hidden in the Polish houses or hiding in the forest. About 300 people came back from the Soviet Union. But when they were coming back to Zamość, they saw that this Jewish community here in Zamość doesn't exist anymore, that there's nothing, no reason to come back here to Zamość. And also they moved to the bigger cities, so they went to Lublin, later to Warsaw. So after World War II there was no reborn of this Jewish community here in Zamość.
We're heading towards the end of our stay, both in your city and in Poland. We don't want to leave our listeners on a sad note, even though everything connected to Poland mm-hmm. for the Jewish community is bittersweet. So looking around, seeing this intact building certainly at least keeps alive the memories of the people who were here before. Do you have maybe a story, maybe an example of something that will sort of warm the hearts of our listeners so that we can finish on a more joyous note?
What is good that the synagogue survived. It was not destroyed by Germans, by accident, because they just needed this building. But it survived. It's open for visitors, open for a Jewish community, and it's here, still in Zamość, looking the same like in the 17th century.
Daniel, it's been a wonderful tour. Probably the most beautiful city I think we've seen on the trip, most colourful. And certainly it's nice at the end of this tour to come to a synagogue that's still standing, that's been well preserved. Your storytelling has been fun. We've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And just come to Zamość to see it.
So that brings us to the end of what has been, for you, the listener, 3 episodes around Poland, and for us, what was an amazing week.
In many ways, it was a pilgrimage, because we were going back to our roots. Both of us have got roots in Poland, although we didn't go to the places that we were from. But we were able to mix Jewish heritage, the tragic stories of the Jews of the modern era, and see some of the other wonderful sites that Poland does have to offer every tourist.
I'd like to say, first of all, a great big thank you to the Lublin Regional Tourist Organisation, and particularly Marcin and Maciek, who were our guides throughout Lublin.
And the other person that we're saving the largest thank you to is Dorota Zadrożna of the Polish Tourism Organisation, who arranged the entire trip and liaised with all the tourism authorities. So a big thank you to you.
One thing we did do in Lublin is we went to the Lithuanian Square, and in that square was a portal, and we waved at people in Vilnius. Do you know what we should do next, David?
I think I've got a very good idea what you're going to suggest.
Should we get to the other side of that portal and wave back?
I think that would be absolutely weird. The question is, would we see ourselves? And if we see ourselves, would we cease to exist?
Well, maybe one of us should stay in Poland.
And one of us go to Vilnius and wave at each other.
And then swap and see if we can get there quick enough.
Okay, we're getting into time machine stuff. Yeah. This is far too detailed.
Doctor Who, music, etc.
So on that note, hopefully the next broadcast or a couple of broadcast time will indeed be from Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, but we leave you very, very happy from the southeastern areas of Poland. So it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from him.
Bye-bye.